Judiciary meeting to order. We're about 2:37. We've got Senator Dyson, Senator Wilkowski, Senator McGuire, Vice Chair, and Chairman Coghill. Today, the only bill on the agenda today is Senate Bill 65, and the intention today is to go ahead and walk through the bill the best way we can. And we have Beth Chapman here. She's going to help us, and I think the way that she intended to do it was to go by topic that would refer to sections.
Okay.
And that will kind of keep things in order, I think, without getting confused. So, and I have my own staff here, Chad Hutchison. So, Beth, identify yourself for those who are listening in, and then begin the description, please.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. For the record, my name is Beth Chapman. I'm an attorney practicing in the estate planning area with an office here in Juneau. And what I was going to do today is approach it on a subject matter so that the sections that are all related to each other for trust versus a limited liability company would be talked about together, and Mr. Sheftel will fill in for the sections that I have not addressed.
And he's on the line, by the way, for questions. So both Dave Chattel and Douglas Blotmarker are online.
Thank you. So I'll start with section 6 through 7 regarding representation for settlement agreements. The amendments to in section 6 as to 1306120, which is the provision we have.
Page number?
I'm sorry, page number 4.
Okay.
This is provision we use for giving notice in all probates and estate matters, particularly to individuals who are either incapacitated, minors, or are not readily ascertainable because they could be future generations and are not yet born. Section 6 simply removes the reference to judicially supervised settlements in any non-judicial proceedings. That was done so that we could clarify what proceedings this notice provision applies to. So section 7, which is on page 7, is where we reenacted this section to provide a definition for what an order is, whether that's a judicial order, a non-judicial order, which could be the result of an arbitration, and also a new definition for proceeding to include non-judicial proceedings and settlement of accounts under any procedure authorized under the probate code. And that's the only change that was made to that provision. And it was done to ensure that all of our non-judicial proceedings, whether they be mediation, arbitrations, or other settlements, are covered under the notice provision. And the next section is section 8, starting on the bottom of page 7. And this relates to the duties of trustees and of co-trustees. And many times as we adopt and draft trusts, we're finding families want a family member to perhaps be overseeing the distributions of the trust, but a different trustee managing the investments. And we have always drafted to allow that. And now we are making it clear that those duties can be granted to different trustees. And if, for example, we grant to one trustee investment powers, the trustee who's only dealing with distributions of the trust assets is not responsible for the investment decisions from the investment trustee. And this is a clarification for drafting that has been done for many years under the current statute.
Senator Wilkowski has a question on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 8, lines 3 and 4. Are we completely exonerating excluded trustees? We're saying they don't have any obligation to review, inquire, investigate, or make recommendations?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is correct, and that is consistent with current statute. If we have a co-trustee that has been delegated one power, they're not responsible for the actions of their co-trustee because they have no authority.
Do they have any responsibilities?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, they do have responsibilities that have been delegated to them. So they're not exonerated for any action that falls within their powers.
So what you're doing here is a clearer delineation of the responsibilities of one co-trustee?
Yes, Senator Coghill, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, if an excluded trustee knows that there's some fraud or something going on, are they still obligated? Are they still excluded from any obligations?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe that they would be responsible because they have an overall fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries, and this is written with an obligation to review, inquire, or investigate. But if they have knowledge of a fraud and they do not disclose it, I would believe that they would be held responsible as their own breach of a fiduciary duty to their beneficiaries.
Maybe Mr. Schaftel has specific on that fraud provision, but next question.
Yeah, just, you know, because it's pretty, the language is extremely broad, and it does say they don't have the obligation to review, inquire, investigate, or make recommendations or evaluations with respect. So it looks like we're just completely exonerating them, and I don't know, maybe that's the way it should be, I don't know.
So maybe it's with respect to the power, so it is directly related to an authority that is assigned to them, is the way I understand it.
Senator Coghill, that is correct. What this is intended to say, that if one trustee has the sole discretion to make distributions from a trust, let me rephrase that. One trustee has the sole discretion to invest trust assets, and one other trustee has sole discretion to make distributions. The distributions trustee does not have an obligation to review what the investment trustee is doing, but I believe that if a fiduciary, regardless of what powers they were delegated, know of a fraud of another trustee, that they would be held liable for not taking action to protect the beneficiaries.
And Mr. Schaftel, is there something that you can add to that, or should we go on and try to catch up with that later?
Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, just to follow up on that, I think that I agree with the analysis. What this is designed to do, practical matters that trustees run into all the time, as Beth has described, very often a client, the person who's setting up the trust, will say, I want my brokerage firm to do all the investments in this, but I want my good friend to handle distributions to my children and my grandchildren. My good friend is not a financial expert, but my good friend is an expert as far as my family goes, knows my family well, and will be able to respond to their needs in terms of distributions. Well, what we want to do here, and this is done nationally, is be able to protect that friend from being sued if this brokerage firm that's managing the assets does a very bad job. It is negligent, or even grossly negligent, as we've seen in the news, unfortunately, on occasion. We don't want that good friend to be sued along with the trustee that was just responsible for the investments. And so these types of statutes, which are very common now and have been enacted around the country in a variety of states, are designed so that you can draft a trust to protect one trustee from another trustee's negligence or gross negligence, certainly not from fraud. If that friend knew that the brokerage firm was engaged in fraudulent activities, or perhaps, you know, as we've seen in the news, something even short of fraud, but something that was outrageous in terms of what they were doing, the overall fiduciary obligation of the family friend who's the trustee would be to call it to everyone's attention and do whatever he or she could do to stop that abuse. But what these provisions are designed to do is to not put the burden on that family friend to constantly be trying to monitor and figure out is that investment firm being negligent or not, for a variety of reasons. One reason is the family trustee doesn't have the expertise to do that. And secondly, he probably wouldn't serve if he had that obligation. But I hope that's helpful.
It is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, continuing on.
Oh, thank you. Section 9s through 11 all relate to a power we refer to as decanting, and it's a significant modification of this statute. Decanting is the ability of a trustee to make changes to the terms of a trust that are in the best interest of the beneficiary. We have had this statute since the late 90s, and we were the second state in the country to adopt this type of a provision. Our current statute, however, was lacking, particularly for protections of the beneficiaries. There was not a lot of guidance given to the trustees on how to use this power. Currently, 19 states have this authority. We followed the New York statute initially, and they significantly revised their statute in 2011. These changes are based on the revisions to the New York statute. And basically what we have done is the trustee can modify the terms of a trust to benefit one or more of the beneficiaries, and what the extent to which they can modify it depends on the authority that they have. If a trustee has the unlimited authority to make a distribution, they could distribute to a new trust that would extend the term of the trust. This is very useful for minors or individuals who may have special needs or may just have problems with drugs or alcohol. And instead of having an outright distribution of the trust, which could be harmful to the beneficiary, they could put it into a new trust and continue the terms of the trust. We have added provisions that limit the trustee's authority to make changes if they have a limited power to distribute. We have added notice provisions to beneficiaries, provided a provision for them to have the right to object for a certain period of time, and have also put in some protections regarding limits on the trustee's authority so that they cannot inadvertently cause tax problems and cannot increase their own compensation or benefit themselves in any way. So these provisions in particular are a significant improvement over our current statute and are very beneficial to the and protective of beneficiaries of trusts. And we use this provision quite a bit to protect beneficiaries, and it's been one of the most useful statutes we've had and can do so without going to court. I'm going to skip over to Section 14, which is on page 18. And again, this is going to relate to the appointment of individuals who are going to help oversee a trust. We talked about trustees who have the fiduciary obligation to manage the trust for the sole benefit of the beneficiaries. We have a current statute that allows for the appointment of a trust protector, which is a non-fiduciary, can be a family member. If we have a corporate trustee, then we appoint this family member as the trust protector to make sure that if there's a problem with the trustee, they can step in and help. And if, particularly if we have beneficiaries who are unable to advocate for themselves. The current statute had required a disinterested third party to act, so it couldn't be a family member, or particularly if that family member may be an ultimate beneficiary at some point in the future. And we are removing that because the practice has been that we are generally appointing family members as the trust protector. And that is the only change to Section 14. Section 15, also on page 18, adds a new provision regarding trust advisors. We also allow for the appointment of an advisor to the trustee, usually in connection with a business where you may want a corporate trustee managing the assets, but you have a particular business interest in the trust, and you want an advisor who can help the trustee and guide the trustee with regards to the operation of the business. And what we have done here is indicate again that, consistent with the current statute, the advisor is not a fiduciary, but we have added a provision that said that the advisor, to the extent that they have advised the trustee has followed that advice, that they could be liable to the beneficiaries as a fiduciary in certain circumstances if they have the exclusive right to tell a trustee to do something. So again, once we delegate the authority to an individual, we're saying you're responsible for exercising that authority, regardless if you're a trust advisor or a trustee. Again, this is going to be very helpful and protective of beneficiaries because they now know who they can look to if there's a problem. Skip over now. Mr. Schefftel is going to come back and cover everything, and I'm going to skip to Section 33, which will start on page 26. We're moving out now of the trust area and into the Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, which is another method that we use to hold assets for a minor child until they reach a certain age. And this was a provision that was brought to our attention, I believe, by Representative Grunberg, because there was concerns that under the current statute, in certain circumstances, the trust is the custodianship is going to end when somebody reaches the age of 18. Well, they may not be mature enough at age 18 or may have had other issues that they should not receive these funds outright. Now they are going, the custodian is going to be given the opportunity to extend the time in which the custodianship account will stay in place, but because the minor is entitled to that and has a legal right at age 18, we have to give them notice that we're going to extend this custodianship, and they have the right to object. If they do not object, then it will continue and be managed for them and, of course, for their sole benefit because it is their funds. And that covers in Section 33 and 34.
Mr. Chair.
And 35.
Senator Wilkowski has a question on that.
As I'm reading this, you have to wait until, okay, so it's 6 months before the last day. You have to give notice 6 months before the 18th birthday?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski. That's correct. 6 months before, the later of 6 months before the last day of the custodial term. And that's because we can have either age 21 and in some cases 25 is the term, but the general is normally age 18, so whichever one is going to occur later. So it's a six-month notice provision. If you do not make the 6 months, then it is going to terminate at that stated age.
Thank you.
Moving on to Section 36, and this is going to go all the way through I guess it's all in Section 36. This is the adoption of the Disposition of Human Remains Act. This is a new chapter to the for the statutes, and the purpose is to allow decedents to leave legally binding directions regarding the disposition of their remains, whether it be cremation or burial, and to also designate an agent to control the disposition of the person's remains. This has become unfortunately, an area that has caused some litigation among family members, that is litigation that should be avoided at all cost. And this will now give us some authority to ensure that if we put into this document that somebody wishes to be cremated, that's going to be legally recognized, and also provides a list of preference of who would have the authority in the absence of a signed direction for the disposition of remains, who would have that authority. And, of course, the first would be starting with any agent that's appointed by the decedent, otherwise a personal representative, and then the spouse. Under current law, you do not have any legal authority to direct the disposition of your remains, and it is left to next of kin, and that can sometimes be a difficult determination. It provides a statutory form. It's very similar to a form we use for advanced health care directives as well as for statutory powers of attorney. So this is something that anybody would be able to go to the statute and be able to complete and would not need legal assistance or the assistance of an attorney to do so.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
did a bill a couple years ago on disposition of remains for military members, and I'm just wondering if this is going to change that at all.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, it will not, and there is a specific provision in here regarding the current law, and it's on page 34, and it's 1375.120 exemptions, and it exempts the disposition of the remains of a member under 2605262 and under the Armed Forces and the U.S. Coast Guard, and I believe those are the provisions that you were referring to.
2605262, you're right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that's all I have, unless there's any other questions.
And let's go to Mr. Schefftel to pick up the remaining pieces of this. Mr. Schaftel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Thank you. Going back to the beginning, sections 1 through 3 provide asset protection for inherited interests in retirement plans and IRAs. And this conforms our law to the majority case rule as has been developed in the bankruptcy courts in the various states. And it also, this type of statute is now being enacted as part of state law, and it's been enacted in Arizona, Florida, and Texas. Sections 4 through 5 clarify a protection that the legislature in Alaska enacted back in, I think it was the late 1990s, and this is one of our provisions that was picked up now as in the vast majority of states, which clarified the law dealing with a partner's interest in a limited partnership or a member's interest in a limited liability company, and clarified that the only remedy that a creditor of a partner or a creditor of a member has is what's called a charging order. And that means they can get an order from the court and sit and wait for distributions to come out of.
Thanks for holding. How may I help you?
Somebody must have come in on that one. So
you can still hear me?
Yes, we can still hear you. They're in and out.
Okay, I'll continue on. So what we're doing here is there's been an issue raised in some states about, well, do these remedies that you cannot have include equitable remedies as well as legal remedies, and that's been the intent of the states that have enacted this law, and we're just clarifying here that that's Alaska's law as well. And we also are stating that these protections for the business entity apply not only for multiple member entities but for single member entities. There is another section later on that I'll touch on that picks up on the same thing for limited partnerships. These particular sections just deal with limited liability companies. Sections 12 and 13 deal with, this is similar to the type of provision we talked about just a few moments earlier about protecting trustees from obligations they should not have. What's very common in the estate planning area is to place insurance policies that the clients have purchased into a trust. And if we do that, we obtain tax benefits because the proceeds of those policies are not taxed under the federal estate tax. But when we do that, generally the clients have selected the policies. And when they do that, they name a friend, for example, as a trustee. They don't want to burden that friend with the obligation of continuing to monitor the insurance company and making sure that it's solvent and that it's investing its funds appropriately to with respect to that policy. So this allows a settlor to set up a trust in that fashion and insulate the trustee, the friend they've chosen as trustee, from liability with respect to those insurance policies. Sections 16 through 32 deal with Alaska's version of the Uniform Principal and Income Act. There were amendments to this act done earlier, and then subsequent to that time, the Internal Revenue Service has issued final regulations that have allowed for more flexibility under this Uniform Act. This flexibility allows a range of interest rates that can be chosen. It provides an explicit definition for income when a trust is drafted initially as a unit trust. It provides for ordering of distributions, the types of income and principal that come out when distributions are made, and it provides for what's called a smoothing period when you're determining the amount that's going to be considered income. So all of these final regulations have allowed us to to enact these changes, which provides for more flexibility with the trust being administered. Going on to section.
Before you go on, Dave, I have a question from Senator Wilkowski.
I probably should know this, but what's a unit trust?
What this is an interesting concept that now has been in the law probably for about 15 years or so. Historically, a lot of trusts were drafted so that they would say, pay all the income to my spouse, and then after my spouse dies, at a later point, divide the principal up among my kids. And the kids may have been from a prior marriage. And so then there is tension on the part of the trustee. Do I invest all these assets to produce income? If I do that, the principal's not going to grow as much. Or do I invest all these assets to in equities so that the principal will grow, but I'll have less income for the spouse? And this has places the trustee in this conflicting role and can get sued from either side. So the concept was, well, let's not just lock it into a concept of income, which we ordinarily think of as dividends and interest, perhaps rent. Let's instead just pick a percentage of those trust assets, let's say 4%. And no matter how they are produced, whether they're produced in the form of what we usually think of as income, interest, or dividends, or whether they're produced in the form of appreciation of equity investments, whatever, however it produced this, we're just going to take 4% of that trust assets every year, say that's income, and that goes to the spouse, and then this allows a trustee, if the trustee says, you know, this year, my analysis and my experts who are advising me say the best thing to do is to put all this into equities. We're not going to have any interest or dividends, but that doesn't matter. I'll get an 11% return on equities, but I'll just take 4% of that. I'll sell it. I'll take 4% of the total assets of the trust. I'll sell that, distribute that to the spouse as, quote, income. And so that's what's called a unit trust. And once they started thinking about this, they determined that it wasn't quite as simple as they thought. They actually, they drafted a number of provisions into the Uniform Principal and Income Act to implement this, and now it works quite well. And so we often put it into trust so that if we have a trust that in the past has been designed to, or in states the income will be distributed to the spouse, we can convert that trust into what's called a unit trust and use this approach. Is that helpful?
Can
I explain that adequately?
Slowly sinking in.
It's sinking in. Thank you, Dave. Continue on.
Slowly. It's not an easy one to explain. So moving on here to Section 37, insurable interest. We've had a concern raised by some cases about whether our statute was adequate to make it clear that those life insurance trusts that I talked about just a few minutes ago, that a trustee can own a policy in a life insurance trust and still be consistent with our insurable interest statute. And you remember, every state has a statute that says that you can only buy insurance policies on someone who you have an insurable interest in, and that's usually your family members or your business, people who you're in business with. We don't want you going out and gambling on strangers' lives and buying insurance policies on their lives. Insurance industry feels very strongly about this. They're adamantly against what's called stranger-owned life insurance. So every state has an insurable interest statute, and we looked at ours after we saw this case law coming out and said, you know, ours isn't as clear as it should be. We want to make it very clear. that a trustee of a life insurance trust who is holding those policies for the benefit of members of the person who set up the trust, that that's an insurable interest. And that's what this provision clarifies.
Section 38
is the companion provision to the LLC provisions I talked about before. But this
David, Senator Wilkowski has a question on the last topic.
Thank you. I saw a Dateline or 60 Minutes or something where it talked about employers buying insurance for their employees. And is that prohibited under Alaska law? Are we changing that with this?
No, that is not prohibited. That would be the same type of thing. I mean, you like group term insurance, where an employer, you know, you have a small business and you are providing an insurance benefit to all of your employees.
No, actually, what was that?
That would not be.
Dave, that's not the question.
Yeah, it was actually just it was larger companies. I think it was Walmart actually who was taking out insurance policies on people that they sort of gamed that thought would die, and keeping the benefits for themselves, not giving it to the employees.
Well, that's something else.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
Our law doesn't allow that right now, as I understand.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Going to Section 39. And this carries over. Yes, this 39. This does a couple of things. It eliminates, and this is in working with legislative affairs, there was a number of deadwood provisions in this statute that needed to be deleted, and so they're being deleted. This one in Section 40. Shorten the statute of limitations on creditor claims from 4 years to 2 years. And this is consistent with the trend that we're seeing nationwide. Hawaii's done the same thing. Nevada, Ohio, South Dakota. Actually, Ohio shortened it even more. It's still a substantial period of time, and it's significantly longer than the four-month limitation period we have when claims are filed against an estate.
Dave, there's a question on this one as well. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. This section concerns me a little bit. This is fraudulent transfers, and I mean, what would the public policy rationale be for limiting when there's a fraudulent transfer from four to two? Help me out there.
Well, it's a public, excuse me, through the chair and Senator Wilkowski, it's a policy call as to what's a long enough period for a statute of limitations. I mean, for example, as you well know, for tort actions, a two-year period of limitations is standard for torts. For, as I mentioned, if we're dealing with, if we're dealing with a probate estate, we have a four-month limitation period. And so, you know, limitation period is one where we're saying you have a reasonable period of time to bring your claim, but after that, you no longer can. We want to clarify the situation. And so what we're seeing is that more and more states are saying 2 years is adequate, and they're amending their law, and so we're proposing to the legislature that our law be amended to be consistent with what seems to be the modern trend here.
Has there been challenges to date at this point on this four-year limitation?
Mr. Chairman, no, not that I've seen. Whatever, we have seen some actions that are brought for fraudulent transfers, and usually they're combined with a number of other causes of action. They're usually brought quite promptly. There's a discovery period as well, so that if a person was not able to get the information necessary, they're given an additional six-month period of time, even if it's beyond the two-year period.
Thank you.
And just on the when you know or reasonably could know, if and I don't know enough about the subject area to even know if this would be a problem or not, but if you didn't find out, let's say you didn't find out for 3 years that there was this fraudulent transfer, does the time run from the time you, I guess it says 6 months after the transfer is reasonably could have been discovered, so then would that allow, let's say I discovered it 3 years later, then I would have 6 months after that time? Is that how that would work?
That's correct.
Okay. And is that a jury decision or is that a judge decision on whether you could have reasonably known?
If it's a question of fact, it would be a jury decision.
Okay.
If it's if there isn't any issue of fact, then it would be for the judge.
Okay.
All right. Continue on.
Okay, Section 41 codifies the common law protection that we all are aware of, that a creditor of a beneficiary can't compel distributions from a trust. And that's our understanding of the law, and that's the understanding in other states. We're seeing more and more states just clarifying that in their statutes. That section also deals with the transfer of IRA interests, and through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think we talked about this last year. This is where a person who has, under present law, a person who has an IRA interest is not able to transfer that interest to a trust. And what this provision does, it's a novel provision, it allows you to transfer your IRA interest to in what would very probably be what's called a grantor trust. And that, so it wouldn't have any income tax consequences, any negative income tax consequences, but it would allow you to place those assets, you'd account for it under the gift tax, but then those assets and the growth of those assets wouldn't be subject to the federal estate tax in the future. Just like the transfer of any other assets you might have right now, but this facilitates the transfer of an IRA interest, which previously was not allowed.
Senator Wilkowski?
And this gets, so that's page 39, lines 21 through 30 you're referring to?
Let me, I've been looking at
Section 3440.118 of the law, transfer of individual retirement accounts?
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, I know the concept of inheritance tax is sort of a big issue. This essentially allows people to skirt the inheritance tax. I mean, this allows people to transfer huge chunks of money from their own IRAs to maybe their kids or friends or somebody else. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, you can do this right now with any other assets you have. I mean, this comes under the general concept of estate planning. You can, and it's not skirting the taxes, because what the tax law allows right now is every individual can transfer up to $5 million. And they have an exempt amount. They use up that exempt amount when they make these transfers, and they can transfer these assets into a trust for the benefit of their family. Now, when they do that, they use up part of their exemption. And if you did that with your IRA, you would similarly use up part of your exemption, depending on how valuable the IRA is. It's just what's different here is the law in the past has said you can't, did not affirmatively allow you to transfer an IRA interest. So we didn't know if you could or not. We've been cautious and nobody's been doing it. But after thinking about it, we see it's a matter of state law. It's not a matter of federal law. And if state law allows it, then that's another asset that you can transfer. Nothing improper about that. It's just we have to be careful about the income tax aspects of it when we do that, because if you were to transfer it in a way that it would be considered a distribution under the income tax, then you'd have to pay taxes right then and there on the full amount, instead of when you take amounts out later on for retirement, or if you die, when your family takes them out. So that's the planning part of it, and that's where, when I mentioned before, that you transfer it to what's called a grantor trust, which again is expressly allowed by the Internal Revenue Code, that kind of a transfer to that kind of trust does not have the negative income tax consequences that I was talking about. So this is nothing that is tax avoidance. It's nothing that you can't do right now with any other kind of asset. It's just clarifying that there is authority for a person to transfer their IRA interest if they want to. If they don't transfer it to a grantor trust, they're going to have income tax consequences, just like if they took all the assets out of their IRA right now, they're going to have income tax consequences. But it does give Alaskans the ability to do some planning with their IRA assets that they couldn't do before.
Senator Wilkowski?
If someone is 65 and they transfer their IRA to their 20-year-old child, let's say, does the 20-year-old, and so if the 65-year-old were to die, their IRA would go to the beneficiary, but they'd have to pay an income tax on it, as I understand it, that now the 65-year-old transfers it to the 20-year-old child. The 20-year-old child then can they cash that, or do they have to wait until the child is then 65 and eligible for the money to be disposed, or how would that work?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this will not change in any way the income tax consequences with respect to that IRA. So what, in answer to your question, there are a number of rules which include when you can start to take distributions out of your IRA and not have to pay a penalty for those distributions. When you start taking distributions, of course, every distribution, whether it's to you or whether it's after your death to your child or your spouse, when a distribution comes out, income tax has to be paid on it. And this doesn't avoid that in any way. The only thing this does is allow you during your lifetime, if you choose, to take all or a portion of your IRA and put it into a grantor trust, so that that IRA, which you've accounted for now under the gift tax, but the real advantage here is the growth of those assets between the time you put it into the trust and when you die later on. So let's take some numbers. If you had a $100,000 IRA and you transferred it into a grantor trust for your family and it grew to $300,000, before you died, that extra $200,000 of growth would not be subject to the estate tax. That's the advantage. And that's the same as if let's assume we're not talking about an IRA now. Let's assume we're talking about a lot, a piece of real property that you own. It's worth $100,000 today, and you say, okay, I'm going to put it into a trust for my family, which would very probably be a grantor trust, and you transfer it in. Well, you're going to have to use up $100,000 of your gift tax exemption amount, that $5 million you can transfer, when you put it in. But then between that time and the time that you die, that lot grows in value from $100,000 to $300,000. Well, you have successfully avoided the growth of that asset from being included in your estate with your other assets and being subject to the federal estate tax. And that's very common and accepted estate planning. That's done all the time. And this just allows you to do it with your IRA now.
All right, continuing on.
Okay. The next sections are 42 through 46, and these deal with our optional community property system, which the legislature enacted in 1998 and has been very popular. All of my clients who are married use this system unless there's some very unique reason not to. What we have found, as every state finds when they have a community property system, that it needs refinement as we go. And so we've clarified a community property trust is one way in which Alaskans can opt into our community property system. And remember, community property in the 10 states that have it now, which are mostly the western states, provides a very attractive income tax benefit when the first spouse dies. You not only get an adjustment up to fair market value of the basis of the assets of the spouse who died, that spouse's half of the community property, but also you get an adjustment of basis of the other spouse's half. And that's a benefit that people in the other 40 states do not get. So that's one reason why this system is so popular. We had a confusing statute of limitations that dealt with claims when there were improper transfers by one spouse or improper gifts, and so that's been clarified so that it makes sense. There have been remedies for improper transfers, so if you have community property, one spouse just can't go and start giving away the community property to some third party, or children for that matter. Both spouses have an interest. And we also, one thing that we have found, and this is something that is unique to community property law in all 10 states, is that spouses can agree that property is community property even though it's titled just in one spouse's name, which is kind of inconsistent with the way we think about property law generally. But that's the reality in all community property states, and we're clarifying that in our law here. And there are several title issues also dealing with beneficiary designations that one spouse can't go out and place a beneficiary designation on community property without the agreement of the other. So these are all clarifications of our community property system. Sections 47 through 50 are really technical provisions dealing with repealed sections and indirect rule change applicability and the two-thirds vote in each house. So that's a summary of the provisions that I was going to summarize, and I think Beth has summarized all of the others. And did we miss any that anyone has any questions
about? Not to my knowledge. And we have slimmed down to a committee that the only thing left I can do is either ask a couple more questions or adjourn. So is there anything else that you'd like to look at?
No, I appreciate the time, Mr. Chair. This is a complex bill, and I just appreciate the walkthrough.
I think the walkthrough was good. It was very helpful to us. My intention was to move it out today. That's not going to happen, obviously. So what we'll do is it'll be the first thing up the next go-around, which is tomorrow at our regularly scheduled time. We'll move it out, and that's the issue this time of year, trying to keep a quorum. So with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.